All right, welcome everybody to today, Living Longer Stronger, Your Best Life After 40. Today I have Lawrence Neal. Lawrence Neal is, a few different things. I first knew Lawrence when he had a podcast called Corporate Warrior. Now it's referred to as High Intensity Business. Correct me if I'm wrong.
That's correct, yeah.
And Lawrence has interviewed, I'm sure you're up to 300 or 400 podcasts now. So he's interviewed folks from within our rational exercise community, outside our rational exercise community, people deal with health and wellness, different things. So theoretically, Lawrence should be the most knowledgeable person on the planet because he's been interviewing all these people for a long time. I know he's been doing this for a while. And by this, I mean exercising for over a decade using high intensity principles, but exercising before that. He's an avid basketball player, and he also currently resides in Ireland, I believe. Is that correct?
That's right. Yep. Galway in Ireland.
And began his own personal training business, very well equipped with some top-notch MedX equipment. And also became a family man in the last few years. Now, before we started recording, I heard you use kids in the plural. Do you now have two children?
I do. I have a son. Yeah, I know. That's how long it's been, Richard. I have a son who's 2.5, and I have a daughter who is 9 months.
Okay. Well, yeah. Maybe we can start by you filling in any blanks or correcting me if I've made any inaccurate statements during the introduction, and just telling us a little bit about your history and how you came to where you are today. I know you also had a background in corporate sales.
There are a few errors, Richard. For one, I'm definitely not the most knowledgeable by a big stretch. I still, you know, get very intimidated by some of my guests who are much, much more knowledgeable than I am. But I have definitely learned a ton, an enormous amount over the last, you know, 10 years or so, or however long I've been doing the podcast. So now, aside from that, I think it was fairly accurate. There might have been a few grandiose things there, but no. Oh, yeah. And in terms of number of podcasts, we're up to 378 is what I'm going to be recording today. So yeah, it's pretty cool to see that number. Yeah.
So, you know, when I said, you know, should be more one of the most knowledgeable, I a bit tongue in cheek, not to degrade, I'm sure that you do have some great knowledge. But where I'm going with this, and one of the things I've been dying to ask you is, as you've listened to a lot of people, you've heard a lot of great information, but you've also heard a lot of contradictory information from different people whom I'm guessing that you hold in high esteem and think of as very knowledgeable and know what they're doing, and yet who disagree with each other. And one of the things I started reading this book, for those listening to an audio version, it's called Noise, and it's subtitled A Flaw in Human Judgment. And it speaks to how, and I'm just in the first couple chapters here, but it speaks to how things like prison sentences in the legal system vary widely from judge to judge for the same crime, or even the same judge on different days, or whether he's sentencing just before lunch when he's hungry, or after lunch when he's had a good meal, or whether the defendant is on his birthday. It also touches on things like doctors giving widely different diagnoses for the same symptoms. And this, again, the same doctor and all these different things corporately and all these things. And as I was reading that, I thought about our community and our community in the rational, I like the term rational exercise. And also in the wider just exercise in general, that a lot of really smart, you know, people who have really done their homework, people with a lot of practical experience, you know, come up with, in some cases, radically different conclusions about, you know, how things should be done. And I remember my wife and I took ballroom dancing lessons, and our teacher said to us one day, the only thing that two dance teachers can agree on is that the third teacher is doing it wrong. I'm just interested, sorry for the long thing, but I'm interested
That's
because you
great.
have a unique perspective. Having done 378, you've heard a lot of viewpoints, you've learned a lot. And I know that with James Fisher, and I think others, or I think it might have been Scholar Tanner, we talked about all roads lead to Rome type of thing. So are we caught up in minutiae? What's your, does that sometimes leave you confused or sort of scratching your head type of thing that you see so many different views?
Yeah, like it's been a massive evolution and journey from the start of the podcast to now. And if you have a lot of patience and you care enough and you go from the beginning, you can really hear me trying to understand, what are the magic bullets? How do we gain tons of muscle mass? I just didn't really have a good understanding around, how genetics mediated that and how how actually the potential for muscle growth for a lot of people is very limited. And as I kind of went through my podcasting journey, I really started to realize that that was very limited. And that was frustrating, obviously, because we're all looking for, I'm a ectomorphic guy. It's hard for me to put on muscle, and anyone who's like me knows that feeling and desires that, right? So it was frustrating at first, and I'd still try and seek out alternative views that would help me figure that out. But then eventually I found it to be the reverse. I found it to be very liberating because I was like, oh, well, if none of this really matters, and as long as I train at a high level of intensity and train to failure, I'm probably going to get, for the most part, what I can get in terms of muscle mass. And I'm going to probably, optimize my health at the same time. Fast forward to now, I'm always, yeah. I mean, the way you preface this with that book is so good because and relevant because I am always now trying to keep an open mind and always trying to learn. And that's why I like to have guests on recently, in fact, whose views I do oppose. I recently had Brad Thorpe on, who's the founder of ISOFIT and a huge proponent of isometrics, and we had a little bit of debate. It's difficult to debate on the podcast because, it's helpful if you have a mediator and sometimes you need a lot more time. And I wanted to cover more ground. So I don't want to spend the whole time like arguing with him over like one thing. But what was became quite clear to me is Brad believes that, isometrics are superior for almost all outcomes that you're looking for from a strength training protocol. Whereas I'm like, yeah, they're just another tool that achieves the same outcome as like dynamic resistance exercise, And you could argue he probably has a lot more confirmation bias because of his products and service. But I don't want to say that he's just like that. I mean, he had a lot of scientific research, and maybe that's just his belief based on his review of the literature. And I did have a look at some of the literature, and actually the outcome I got to through reviewing that was that, for instance, there was one study on that tried to show, or that he used to show, that there was a bigger strength improvement, I believe. I'm forgetting some of the details, through isometric training than dynamic resistance exercise. And when you look at the research, as we've seen over and over again, the study design for the group that did the dynamic resistance exercise was like really low intensity and like 3 sets of 10. It was like, it wasn't, it didn't, manage those other variables very well. And so, it's probably not a great study design, and that results in a flawed study. So yeah, that's I'm always trying to keep an open mind. I'm always trying to understand, am I missing something? Is there someone out there who is a really learned in a certain part of exercise, and I can glean something from them. And so I'm always ready to challenge this hypothesis that, all roads lead to Rome. But what I've found is through doing so, it's only reinforced that belief. And that, you know what I'm saying? So it's like I try and keep an open mind, I try and hear the counter arguments. But in doing so, I've just each one's kind of fallen down flat when I've really tried to unpick it, if that makes sense. And I think that's a great way to be, right? Is it's really healthy, whether you're thinking about diet or politics or anything, to, and people are terrible with this with politics, right? They like their team and they get all kind of ideological. But it's really important to review the counterview and try and find the best, most intellectually honest counterview you can, and then try and smash it up against the other view, or your you know, the view that your confirmation bias is kind of focusing on. And through doing that, you will actually develop a much better understanding. And if you're correct in your assumption, then that is only going to be fortified through that work, if that makes sense. However, that all being said, I'm in a WhatsApp group with Skylar Tanner and Dr. Bryce Lee and Blair Wilson and Owen Dockham and a couple other people. And, you know, these guys are close friends of mine and, in my opinion, some of the top personal trainers and most knowledgeable exercise experts on the planet. And you know, we were talking recently about bulking up and, you know, without getting into all the details and, you know, exposing their views on this, there seemed to be some talk about, okay, you know, if I do this supplement stack along with my training and I train twice a week, full body, and I eat a calorie surplus of X, I could gain, but we're talking super, super marginal gain, right? Like 0.5 pounds of lean mass per month or something like that. So, which isn't very controversial, right? That's I think even in those of us who are kind of in the all roads lead to Rome camp, we probably agree that you could put on, you know, very tiny amounts of lean mass over the long term. And obviously after a certain age, that becomes very challenging. And then it's more of a maintenance game, obviously. So that I can believe. Like, I mean, if you really dial everything in, if you really get your sleep dialed in, which is something that is a challenge for me right now, and you really dial the diet in and you really control the caloric intake, and maybe there are certain supplements that might help, and you get your training just right, then maybe, yes, you can increase beyond, you know, you can continue to gain muscle. I just think it's always going to be at a super, super limited rate. And it all comes back to, I think, you know, pretty much what Doug McGough's been saying this whole time, which is, you know, the role that myostatin plays in terms of limiting the amount of muscle you can put on, the genetic hand you were dealt at birth. Like, I just think genetics seems to constantly get overlooked when we're talking about, you know, the latest protocols and things. And like, that is really what's going to determine the outcomes here. So I don't know if that really answers the question, but I guess that's where I am currently. And when I think about this for myself, I think I am not in the optimization part of my life. I am at the just trying to get to tomorrow phase of life. So how that manifests is, it's like, if I can get 2 full body workouts in a week, I do like a kind of A-B split routine, but you could argue that both are full body. Because, you know, one will have a vertical pull, one will have a horizontal pull, for example. And if I do that, and if I eat relatively well, and if I just get as much sleep as I can, and I try and manage my stress, I'm sort of like going to maintain where I'm at. And frankly, I'm quite happy with my physique and my level of my body composition. But I was talking to Blair actually quite recently about bulking up, and he was helping me and giving me some advice and some guidance. And a lot of what he said, I didn't agree with.
Blair Wilson?
Yeah, Blair Wilson. Yeah. Like, I didn't agree with, and it really challenged me. And I was like, oh, this is, and part of you is like, you know, I don't know whether other people have this or you have this voice in your head, Richard, where it's like, I already know this stuff, you're wrong, da 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 da. Right. But that's not necessarily a healthy perspective. You should be prepared to challenge your pre-existing beliefs, right? And so he was giving me some advice, and I thought, yeah, and I started almost creating a plan. And then I took that plan and I just parked it. Cause I was like, there's no way at the stage of life I'm at with these two young kids and the two businesses, the studio business, the online business, I'm going to be able to do this. Cause a lot of it is based on getting a really good amount of sleep. You know, you can get everything else right, and it's really clear if you don't sleep well, you know, from a recovery point of view, it's just, you're just not going to get the results, I don't think. So yeah, I've parked it for now.
you made probably a dozen excellent points. That's one of the reasons I was happy to give you a chance to, you know, you're always asking the questions, you do that very well. But of course, because of, you know, you've seen so many different perspectives, and, you know, there's kind of like best in the lab and best in the real world. Right. And in the lab, which of course I could go off on a tangent, maybe we'll come back there later, about the limitations of a lot of exercise research, or I would even go as far as distortions in many cases. But, you know, when you talk about the best, and I who is it that says, you'll tell me, the best workout is the one you're actually doing. And yeah, the fact is that most people, you know, when you got no kids and maybe you're in college and you don't have a big workload or whatnot, then you can experiment with all kinds of different things. But at the end of the day, as you of course are living today, and you know, that's not atypical. People reach a stage in their life where they're trying to establish themselves in business, they're raising young families, they're doing volunteer work. And of course, they want to spend time with their significant other and try to have some quality time and whatnot. At the end of the day, I think the argument I would make for what we do being best is that you can actually stick to it during the types of things. Like, let's say that you established hypothetically that, you know, three times or four times a week, you know, or 3 days on, 1 day off, was going to give you significantly better results than anything else. You wouldn't be, there's no way you could do it if you wanted to.
Yep, totally.
And the other side of it too is, and I think, is that you can do this for years and decades. And we've seen that. Whereas, you know, some of the things you talked earlier about, a gentleman who, you know, with the use of a performance enhancing drug put on 40 pounds and things like that. But is he going to be able to do that? Notwithstanding, let's assume that he's, you know, being careful and that the side effects of what he's doing are not as horrible as some would do. Is he going to be do that and maintain that? No, it's going to be something he'll look back on at some point and say, wow, look at what I was then. But I doubt that he'll be able to do that for life.
Yeah, something has to give, right? It's like, I don't understand how Elon Musk can be a great parent to like seven kids and run all his businesses. And the fact is, he can't do it all. He's not, you know,
right.
Not to judge him too harshly, because I think his genius is so incredible that we need him to focus on his businesses for the greater good, but there's a sacrifice. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. Richard Branson, I read his autobiography, or I don't know if it was a full, it's called Screw It, Let's Do It. He did a number of things. He's renowned as being this great guy. But if you read his autobiography, he could have simply have been a statistic of a crazy guy who killed himself, because he went on these balloon rides, I forget now, and he wrote letters to all his kids before he left saying, if I never come back, here's my final message to you. So here he was, a family man, and basically risking his life, you know, and going out. So, you know, you could say as much as he's admired and everything else, but as a family man, he was being pretty irresponsible.
Yeah, it's one of my biggest, not to digress too much, but it's one of my biggest challenges, because I'm very type A driven. You know, I like to obviously focus on the business, and it's hard for me to step away and to be a good parent. And thankfully, I think I'm doing a pretty good job. And I've never been good with kids before having kids, and now I have my own. I feel very natural for me to bond with them. But it still continues to be difficult for me. Yeah,
sure. And it's always going to be a challenge. But at the same time, remember, if I may, and old guys like to give advice, right? So if I may, you're also providing a power of example. Because if, let's say, I mean, you could always, using an extreme example, you could stay home and be a stay-at-home dad and let your businesses slide and everything else. But then, you know, what would they look up to? So you'll always struggle with the balance. But I'm quite confident, because you're consciously seeing it as one of your priorities, you know, and you'll get better and better. And of course, Stephen Covey, again, we're digressing, but, you know, Stephen Covey and the Seven Habits, highly effective people, and he's a big proponent of balance between life and work and all these things. But he says the greater overall balance in your life is subject to periods of extreme imbalances. So when you're starting a new business, it's going to be imbalanced for the first few years. If you're when you're a brand new dad, it's going to be imbalanced for a few years. So, you know, it's just a reality. You know, it's like when your kids are 10 and 12, if you're still spending the amount of time and constant attention, both you and your wife, of course, a team thing, that you were when they were 0 and 2, then you're imbalanced. But at this point in time, right, same thing with your business. When it's 10 and 12 years old, if you haven't gotten it into a sort of more or less automatic thing where things are happening more or less automatically, then you need to look at it. and you know, much easier for me to give advice than to put it into practice, right? It's a constant challenge, but at least if you recognize the goal, right? So another thing I wanted to ask you is, if you had to pick, and I know this is tough because, and you can, I'm putting you on the spot, your top five people that you've interviewed, if you would say tomorrow, there's five people I'm going to go on a desert island with, and let's assume your criteria is just, because obviously it would be your wife and your children and things like this, but your criteria was the most knowledgeable people that, you know, you'd like to hang out with from the point of view of exercise, wellness, and whatnot. So that's probably a totally unfair question, but just speculate a bit.
I will. And just before I say that, I just wanted to say as well, and maybe we'll get to this, but I'm thinking about your audience, you know, your potential clients, your prospects, other HIIT enthusiasts. I think it's really important to say that HIIT has been my salvation during parenthood. Like, I would not have, you see so many dads become, you know, they their bodies turn into dad bods, right? Once they have kids, because they're sleep deprived, they're stressed, their eating habits are terrible, they're not exercising, they have no energy. And, you know, if it wasn't for knowing that I could get a really good workout in 30 minutes, whether that's sometimes I do that from home at the studio, like once a week, because I probably train on average like twice a week right now, but for a long time it was like once a week, certainly at the early stages with the first. There's no way, there's absolutely no way I would have maintained good appearance and health to this point. So that's why I think going through this experience has made me even more evangelical about HIIT, not because it's the best way for building muscle. And my view on that, Richard, is well, as we've kind of been alluding to, is all roads lead to Rome. You could do any resistance exercise protocol. If it's intense enough, you're probably going to get the same outcome over a long enough period of time. I do think that's probably true, at least getting like 90%. And I don't know where I was going with that now, but yeah, I find that this approach has been so sustainable and so effective for me during this time. To answer your question about the five people, the first name that came to mind was obviously Dr. Doug McGuff. I think in terms of the most knowledgeable, I think in our space. Gosh, who else? So I'm not going on who I'd like to spend time with, because that might change the answer a little bit. I'm going on most knowledgeable, right? Do you mind if I just bring up the list quickly?
Sure.
I know this is cheating, but it will just help me a little bit.
That's cool. And while you're doing that, I'll make a quick comment.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes our obsession with getting bigger muscles and whatnot might have to do with comparing ourselves to others, which we shouldn't do in the first place, but comparing ourselves to the wrong people. We look at the people on the magazine covers. When you alluded to dad bods, as if we were going to compare ourselves, which is still wrong, but if you were going to, just go through the local shopping mall or whatnot and look around, and you and I are freaking, we're supermen, right? Yeah, compared to the average population, not to make it sound arrogant or whatever it is, but most people, you know, see it, you know, as we would be considered really fit and really great shape and whatnot. Yeah. But of course, we get caught up in wanting to look like Casey Viator.
Yeah, I fully agree. And just so to answer the original question, okay. I think James Steele, it's a close one between those two. I might consider Fisher in that five, but James Steele, I think he's probably one of the most brilliant thinkers in exercise science. And I think he's so intellectually honest, and so is James Fisher, to be fair. They're both great. And I think his the fact that he's taken, like, the way I understand it is he's almost taking the science to another level with his mathematical approach he's explored recently on my podcast, which took me ages to get my head around the ideas he was exploring there. But I feel like he might be taking this whole thing to another level. I mean, the outcomes, the, you know, from this, the research might just be as disappointing as we've been talking about, in terms of, you know, not, you know, there not being a huge potential in terms of people putting on much muscle mass beyond what they get in the first, whatever, 6 months to a year or 2 years. But it just might be a, I don't know, a clearer view on all of this stuff. So James Steele, Dr. James Steele, Doug McGough, Dr. Doug McGough. I'd also say Luke Carlson. Now, you might think, well, you know, Luke's very knowledgeable about, you think about him being knowledgeable about business maybe before personal training. But Luke is actually, like, as knowledgeable about exercise as almost anyone I've had on my podcast, because he actually reads, I hope you don't mind a little bit of commentary after each one of these, a little bit of a reason why. But he reads exercise like every week. You know, he's reading scientific journals every single week. He is obsessed with that side of it. And he's also a really critical thinker. You know, he's prepared to challenge his pre-existing beliefs, and he's very intellectually honest. It's one of the reasons why I love having him on the podcast, or love talking to him, because he gets excited when I, like, challenge his viewpoints. He doesn't get defensive. So he'd be another. John Little's got to be there. John Little's got to be there. He's number four. Because John Little, okay, maybe I'm being a bit biased because I just really like John and I like this philosophical side to him, but he'd be very knowledgeable. And let me just, I'm looking at my list of podcasts here to see who's going to take the fifth spot here. Okay. I've got someone in mind. Let me just see. Hang on, just give me a minute here. I'm going to say, I'm not going to think too long. I'm going to say Skylar Tanner.
Okay. I was suspecting that Skylar would be on that list.
I'm going to say him. I'm looking at the rest of the names, and yeah, I think those are the five. And I think I've picked those guys because they're all really knowledgeable about exercise, but they're also really open-minded. And if you had them all there on an island, you were debating stuff, it would be much more productive. Because I think a lot of the other people I've had on my podcast who I haven't listed, and this is not everyone, it's just some people, are very defensive of their beliefs and are not willing to, you know, drop that belief and replace it with a new one because it's too uncomfortable. And that's a normal human condition, right? We always want certainty of our knowledge, and reality is that, you know, 50% of what we all think is true is probably not.
So when you name those people, what was going through my mind, and you alluded to it, is I was thinking we were using the word knowledgeable, which implies, you know, having a large amount of knowledge. But I haven't listened to a lot of Luke Carlson interviews, but certainly Doug McGough and Skylar Tanner and James Steele, is the manner in which they think about exercise. Yeah. And the critical thinking and the things that they consider. And sort of like you say, if there was a debate, a conversation, it wouldn't just be a rhyming off of rules and whatnot. It would be, and what I've tried to take the attitude, not just about exercise, but life in general, is more along the lines of, based on the information that I've been exposed to, based on the experiences that I've had, this or that seems to make the most sense to me at this time, until I'm presented with other evidence that contradicts it. And earlier, I think you also basically alluded to the scientific method really well when you say you start with a hypothesis and then you continually try to prove it wrong, which is, you know, and be prepared to prove it wrong at any point in time, because the human body is really complex. I think too, a lot of exercise research, because, you know, funding goes to where there's demand. And of course, with professional sports and people who are looking, they're always looking to optimize so somebody can have a world record to win a world championship and things like that, and the various nuances, which in many cases, for these athletes that are doing it for a living, you wonder, notwithstanding their genetic superiority to the vast majority of the population, how much of that really matters to you and I? Or the guy with the dad bod who's trying to get rid of his dad bod and just wants to age well, right? It becomes an awful lot of hair splitting, right? The other
And
thing.
they would, and you could argue that a lot of them would succeed without a lot of those interventions.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, at that point. Well,
Right.
one of the things I'd like to know your thoughts. I was listening to, actually, I won't name names. I was listening to, you would recognize the name, but different people that are talking and are held in high esteem, and they talk about, and I have a hard time. My confirmation bias comes into play when I start to hear somebody say, in order to develop power, you need to do X, but if you want to develop speed, you need to do this. And if you want to develop strength, you need to do this. But if you want hypertrophy, you need to do this. Well, with the exception of hypertrophy, none of those terms, to my knowledge, you may have looked at other things, are very well defined. Like, what is power? What is speed? If you were like doing research for physics or engineering, then things like torque, speed, velocity, and all those things would be very clearly defined. But an exercise, I spoke to Daniel Thompson the other day, and he is an exercise guy. You probably know of him, and but also took school in engineering. He says most exercise research, if it was shown to engineers, would they would look at it and say, the terms aren't defined. Like James Fisher was going over this idea that the optimal amount for hypertrophy is, I forget, 10 sets per body part per week. And I'm thinking, what does that even mean? What's the definition of a set? And so are we counting warm-up sets?
I mean, this is such a good point. Like, James Steele has done tons of research looking at like defining terms in exercise, focusing mainly on effort. And how ambiguous that is. And he's wrote a couple of papers on that, I think, with the likes of James Fisher. Just to be clear on the whole 10 sets per muscle group per week. So that's obviously, I think the main paper that looked at that was led by Dr. Brad Schoenfeld. And I've done a couple of podcasts now with Dr. James Fisher, and it just seems so clear to me that it's just not necessary. Like if you look at this, the don't know if you've seen this, Richard, but if you look at the differences in the percentage gained across the different volumes of sets, it's negligible, such that you wouldn't even see it with the naked eye. Like it's like, I can't remember specifics, but we're talking like, millimeters of additional growth or something like that. Like the because the percentages are relative, they're not absolute. And I don't understand why people don't see that, even some people in our industry, and realize that, the whole 10 sets thing, and even probably, I don't know, six sets is probably erroneous and not going to produce anything greater. We're talking specifically here about muscle hypertrophy. Hey, if you want to do it for other reasons, be my guest. But if you're looking to optimize, it's just not worth it. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's laughable. That I just want to make that. So that's not, I don't want, because James has actually would probably agree with me on a lot of that. And we've discussed it. So he wouldn't tout saying that, oh, we should all be doing that, but he's kind of the view, look, I'm just going to say, fine, yes, that is optimal because technically it is, but we're talking about, a negligible improvement. So he's been quite clear about that. So I don't want to misrepresent his view on that.
James Fisher and James Steele, I find, are very diplomatic, and maybe there's a certain etiquette among scientists about how they put things, because sometimes, and of course, they're listening to this, they can of course correct me or whatnot, but this is my perception. So I'm not saying what I'm saying is true or not. My perception is they're trying to be as respectful as they can. I would suggest sometimes maybe even to the point where they maybe do that too much, as opposed to calling a spade, as opposed to, of course, the other end of the extreme would be maybe a Ken Hutchins or a Drew Bay, who would just simply call bullshit, right? And or of course Fred Hahn or these type of things, and maybe somewhere in the middle you could be maybe a little less abrasive than some of the latter. But I also think sometimes, like I think you did it really well the way you did it, like it's so small, notwithstanding also that it seems like sometimes some of the studies are even cherry-picked, it appears, to show which ones tend to. And Doug McGuff talked about I'm going to pronounce this word wrong, advocacy, A-D-V-O-C-A, advocacy, mm-hmm. research, where mm-hmm. basically...
Oh, advocacy, yeah.
Advocacy, yeah. That's a word. And obviously, English is actually not my first language, by the way. And and where people start off a research, like you say, instead of trying to disprove the theory that they allude to, they're more or less starting the research looking for ways to confirm the theory, you know, because of course Brad Schoenfeld likely does 10, 15 sets a week and trains so often. And
I don't know, Richard, I'm not sure if I believe that. I did think that when I first had Brad on the podcast like years ago, and I felt like he was so, it's quite interesting. Like I actually was being fooling myself, that I was being the open-minded one, when all I was doing when I first spoke to Brad is trying to understand how he was wrong, because obviously our way was the best way, you know. And through more exposure to him and seeing him produce more research over the years, and I guess more recently, I actually think he's been very balanced. I actually think because you know, some of his most recent work, which got published in, I think, New York Times, actually advocated for lower volumes, or saying that if you know, do you remember, I can't remember the name of the article, but it's like, if you don't have time, this is what you should do, or whatever. And he's kind of responsible for helping us get on the map more so in terms of getting more popularity for high intensity training. So I don't know whether I'm right about this, but I just feel like he's more, maybe he's always been quite intellectually honest and actually has been trying to, what is it they say? Look for the null hypothesis, trying to actually prove himself wrong and be objective about his research. If not in his, you know, a few years ago, certainly now I feel like his work does. Like, because obviously he'll collaborate with, you know, James Fisher and James Steele and lots of scientists who we respect. And, you know, having reviewed some of those papers in the last, you know, year or so, I feel like there's a lot less bias in those papers. So that's my take. Yeah.
Well, and I appreciate the clarification. Maybe I should, you know, earlier I said I wouldn't name names, so maybe I shouldn't have, because maybe he was a bad example. And also, in fairness to Drew Bay, recently I saw him do a post on Facebook in Blaine's Hit, where he referred to Brad Schoenfeld as, I'm going to misquote, but something about being more intellectually honest than most and hoping, thinking that Brad may be coming. So, you know, in that case, Drew was not, you know, abrasive or critical of Brad in general. So, and I think more and more, you know, things are going to, you know, become, there's maybe more of a unified type of thing among at least exercise. That's why, you know, earlier I said I like the label rational exercise, and because HIIT, I just find is a, I don't know, I just find there's a number of issues with that, not the least of which that it gets mixed up with HIIT, and it makes it sound like intensity is the founding principle of it all, when there's so much more to it than that. And even evidence-based, I struggle with, because you can find evidence for anything, right? If you look for it, there's going to be a study someplace that shows evidence for just about, it's almost like religious people who will argue about what it says in the various book, whether it's the Quran or the Bible or whatever it is, you can find a quote in there to basically justify any point of view. Mm-hmm. And if you want to play the devil's advocate, you can find another quote in the same book to contradict it. I find that a lot of times with scientific research, if you want to find evidence for whatever point you're trying to make, if you look hard enough, you'll find it. So that's why I kind of struggle with evidence.
But I've never, well, maybe I need to get better at reading science, but I've never understood the whole cherry picking idea, because it's like, well, yeah, I mean, someone can cherry pick research, but if you're only really abstract, then they look like they're it's really good quality research and it supports their point of view. But when you dig into, that's why I love the scientific method. It's like when you dig into the study design, then you can start to see all the flaws. But obviously most people don't take the time to do that. But, and maybe that's why cherry picking works. And maybe that's why people just see the studies and they don't read the studies. They just read the source material. Right. So maybe I'm answering my own question.
Well, the scientific method is the gold standard when used with integrity. But there are, what's the word I'm looking for? There are conflicting interests that come into play. And I think one of the main one is the need to get funding for whatever research you're doing. So even outside the realms of exercise, for example, let's say, not to go down a rabbit hole, but let's say that you wanted to show that cholesterol does not cause heart disease, right? And I'm not gonna get into an opinion on whether it does or doesn't, just an example. Well, you're not gonna get a lot of drug companies who fund a lot of the research if you go and try to get a research grant to do that, when you say, this is the hypothesis that I'm trying to explain, you know, good luck with that. And even sometimes, maybe if you're trying to show that cholesterol does cause heart disease and that statins will save your life, then you'll get the research. But if your research comes up with a different conclusion, you'll often see if you read, it showed this, but it's inconclusive and more study needs to be done. They're very hesitant to say something like, this shows that, you know, maybe all that money we've been spending, the billions of dollars on statin drugs over the last few years may have been, again, not to get into that, but the funding, there's no question. And now that's the point where somebody is being integrity. Now, does it happen that people actually fudge things? I have to think that I have no idea how prevalent it is, but I have to think that in some research that does happen. And some of the research that's done is done by students who, you know, they're trying to get a mark and trying to get a grant, and, you know, they may have partied at the pub night the night before and they finished their study real quick and got it out. But the study reads, when it gets to the mainstream newspaper, it says studies out of this university show that blank. Well, it was a bunch of students who did it as part of their thesis. Yeah.
Well, this is why we have, I guess, the double blind peer reviewed, you know, gold standard for research.
Right.
But I hear what you're saying, and, you know, even the reviewers weren't there in the lab sometimes, right? So I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how they figured that out. But, and I've heard people say, oh, you know, and you probably heard this on my podcast, like, research is a crapshoot. You know, were you there? Were you there when they did those sets? You know, and I'm like, well, if you start thinking like that, surely you just don't believe anything. and that's almost a non-starter. That's enough to drive you insane. You know, right. We need a starting point. We need to maybe trust some of these sources, and maybe by it being double blind and peer reviewed and really good study design, or at least what it, you know, it seems in the paper, maybe that's what we should be striving for and have faith. I don't know.
Doug McGough talked about tinkerers, and he was referring, among others, to Arthur Jones. And now some of the knowledge that we come into play started out not in a lab, not in a scientific experiment, by tinkerers. I mean, Arthur Jones, my understanding, had a grade 9 education and just sort of had ideas and put them into practice. And now decades later, it seems like he was way ahead of the game. And
Yeah,
if you
that's
look
the
at
answer. Yeah.
history, long before there was trigonometry and algebra and things that architects use today to build structures, some of the greatest structures were built by the Romans and the Greeks that are still standing today, who had no idea about those things. And then sometimes science comes in after the fact and shows why it works. And then sometimes Nicholas Nassim Taleb, author of The Black Swan, will say, and then sometimes science will say it was their idea in the first place. So
Yeah,
there's that.
I love this idea. And in fact, I was talking to a client about, business brand positioning. And there's obviously it's quite popular in our space to have one of your unique differentiators to be evidence-based, right? Because there is plenty of evidence now to show that what we do is really effective. But there's a lot of stuff that this particular client does that isn't evidence-based, but might be highly beneficial. As maybe, it's the whole absence of evidence is an evidence of absence or whatever it is. And maybe the research will come out in 20 or 30 years to show that some of his interventions are very effective. Or maybe it will never come out because no one will ever do the science because
Sorry, I
it
miss
doesn't make sense.
who are we talking about?
I won't name names because
Oh, okay, all right, just a
yeah,
certain client.
I'll keep them nameless for
Oh,
now.
okay, sorry.
It's okay, it's fine. But I love the fact that he's like, you know what? I understand this whole evidence-based thing, but we do a bunch of stuff around breathing, around other kind of movement-related stuff, which, we feel is valuable through our own experience, through tinkering, as you say, but the
Right.
research may be not there to support it. And so we've decided that's not going to be part of our brand. We're not going to say everything we do is evidence-based. We can say when a client uses, our equipment, because they do high intensity strength training in their business, we can say it's evidence-based, but we're not going to identify as everything we do evidence-based. And I thought that was quite smart because I thought, if you believe in these other approaches and you think they're really beneficial and that's happening for your clients, then yeah, you've got to be careful. You can't have a say-do gap. You can't say we're evidence-based and then you do stuff that's kind of woo, right? You've got to be consistent and congruent with that. So yeah, anyway, just I thought that would be quite interesting to say because I love the idea of self-experimentation and tinkering and like you say, not waiting for the research, just trying to figure out what works for you and works for your clients.
Smoke and Mirrors. It's actually not one book. It's actually three or four books written by Randy Roach.
Yeah, I'm
So
familiar. I'm yet to read that, but yeah, I've heard much about that.
Randy is, it's a history of the strength game from way back to the beginning of the 20th century and just before. And it's amazing how many things these old time bodybuilders, came up with from tinkering that now are being, oh, okay, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, in many ways, these guys were, because even a lot of what Arthur Jones come up with was not, Peary Rader and Mabel Rader and these people. A lot of these guys were doing, talking about these things long before. So, like you say, and the other thing I think is placebo. If you want to call it that, or just, Ellington Darden has talked about it's important for people to believe, and I think he was quoting Arthur Jones, that they believe in the program that they're doing, the extent to which they really believe. And if you look at some of these transformations, for example, in some of the Darden books that were done, now obviously one of the things I realized since is that Darden and Jones were really good at picking genetic potential. Like if you're going to be in the book, they're going to look at you and in a glance, they can look at the length of your muscle bellies and things like that and say, yeah, that's the guy for the book. But, think to yourself, if you were asked, if Ellington Darden said to you, in which you are featured, and I will train you exclusively, and we're going to dial everything in your diet and everything else. And that was, and you knew that you were going to be published in this book. And maybe it was going to be a collaboration of Ellington Darden, Doug McGuff, and Skylar Tanner. Then do you think that mentally would have an effect on your results, right? It's no secret
Yeah.
that world records are rarely broken in practice. They are broken on during
Yeah.
the Olympics. They are broken on the world
And the
championship
adrenaline
day.
is pumping.
Yeah. So, you know, and to what extent? I even think some of the guys that go to the gym and are surrounded by big, bulky guys are, to some extent, that has a contributing factor to success, because all of a sudden you're seeing the evidence, even though we know that, you know, there's all kinds of confounders in there, but if you really believe it, you know, does it have an effect? And I think it probably has a greater effect. Arthur Jones used to say, and was ridiculed later, maybe ridiculed, that he didn't think steroids worked. He thought steroids were all placebo. And of course, later people said, no, there's no way. But even then, I sometimes ponder, if you started to take steroids tomorrow, would you pay also closer attention to your diet? Would you workouts be different with different things? I don't think it would be all placebo, but I think placebo would likely play a role. I wonder if any studies have been done where you had a control group that was told they were getting steroids.
Yeah, that would be fascinating.
Compared
Maybe
to
it exists.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although that would be, there'd be massive ethical issues with that one, right? That would be the issue.
Yeah, that's right. That's why I suspect that may not have been done.
If it has been done, it's like 50 years ago. Because it wouldn't get through today. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm
guessing we're getting close to our time. Am I correct?
That's right. Unfortunately, I could talk for a lot longer, but hopefully this has been productive for you.
This has been really fascinating. I started to do these, and I don't know where this is all going, but I know that it's fun to have an opportunity. And I was not, I knew I wouldn't be, but I was not disappointed, because your perspective is unique, having done 371 podcasts. And also, I would list you among the people who are critical thinkers, who look at it from a great point of view. And I really appreciate your sharing your thoughts today. And
You're
I'm
welcome.
Sure listeners and viewers of this will also do so in the future.
And also, you know, even Daniel Kahneman, who wrote that book Noise, and he wrote Thinking Fast and Slow, he talks about how he gets caught all the time. Like, he is fallible to all the human biases all the time himself. So if, like, the guy that won like Nobel Prize in research in this still screws up, like, that gives a lot of confidence to the rest of us. And I will just say, I don't know if you're aware of this, Richard, but I did a series all about this stuff, all about decision making and biases, with Dave Smith, PhD. I don't know if you're familiar with that series, it's on the podcast. And if you just search Dave Smith on the site, you'll find it. But he was the one who collaborated with James Fisher and Steele back in the day to bring a lot of Arthur Jones's theories to the scientific realm and produce papers on that. And he's a psychologist by, you know, he's his specialty. And so we did a whole series on this stuff, on this critical thinking stuff. It's absolutely fascinating. I learned a huge amount.
Oh, so, great. Yeah. I'll check those out.
Yeah, do.
So, once you're ready, if you can send both the audio and the video file.
I will.
And that's great. And I will get you to your next appointment. I know you have a hard stop. Thank you much. I know you're real busy, father, two businesses, everything else. So this is greatly, greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Rich. It's my pleasure. All right, talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.